I guess when I'm saying networking, we're saying broad networks. And I think there's people need to understand there's different types of networks, whether it's sponsors or mentors or others. So I guess what I'm saying here is that you need a lot of different people to help you during your career, because actually we're talking about leadership. Leadership is all about leading others and having followers. But to learn how to be a leader, you probably need others to help you. So it's actually recognizing that you just can't be doing the job. If you want to be actually able to succeed and go into leadership, you need the help of others.
Hello and welcome to podcast 10 Lessons Learned, where we dispense wisdom, not just information, not just facts, not just mere platitudes, to an international audience of rising leaders. In other words, in this podcast, you'll hear valuable insights that you cannot learn from a textbook because it took us years to learn this stuff. My name is Jeffrey Wang, the founder of Professional Development Forum and your host. This podcast is sponsored by the Professional Development Forum, which helps diverse young professionals of any age find fulfillment in the modern workplace. Today, we're joined by Karen Loon. Karen Loon is a non-executive director, a former partner at PwC Singapore. She has worked with the world's leading banks and led diversity initiatives. She has qualifications in system psychodynamics, that's a big word, and governance from INSEAD. And research interest in identity work and organizational change, which we'll get to in a minute. She's also the author of a recently released book, Fostering Culturally Diverse Leadership in Organizations. So I know also from reading about you in the news that you are fourth generation Asian Australian growing up in the country town of New South Wales called Tamworth. There's a theory that the reason why culturally diverse people aren't getting into leadership is because, you know, they haven't assimilated to the culture yet. But, you know, looking at you, probably as Australian as one could possibly be, you know, of an Asian background. So even you can see that there is an issue, then potentially that the issue is much, much bigger.
Yeah, no, definitely. Thanks for the kind intro. But no, it's interesting because as I actually looked at my own story, because I think part of the whole research I did was around my own story and understanding, I've realized how much has been shaped by the experiences of my grandparents, and their experiences were quite different to ours. But, you know, some of those challenges that they faced, actually becoming Australians and feeling like they're Australians, I think are still things that I experience in a way today. So it's been a fascinating journey.
Absolutely. And you did start your journey in Australia, in your professional journey. Do you think you would have gone as far as you did if you did not leave for Singapore?
Yeah, unfortunately not. I mean, it was challenging at the time for women, I think. And I recall I hadn't seen, you know, a lot of female leaders, but definitely it was probably only 5 years before I made it to partner. So maybe in the late 90s when you actually really started to see Asian Australians make it into, say, partnership levels in most of the firms. So it's unfortunate. And, you know, to me, that's something that I want to try and see we can change for the next generation.
If you want to find out more about her research, you can certainly check it out in her latest book, Fostering Culturally Diverse Leadership in Organizations. So without much ado, let's jump into your lessons then. Lesson number one, life is full of patterns that we continuously repeat. What do you mean by that?
I used to have a big client I worked with in Singapore for a couple of years. And I'd go along, I was an audit partner, and he was quite serious. Also, whenever you got something or you came up with a point of view that he didn't agree with, he'd actually sort of lash out with you a bit aggressively, no matter whether you were an internal staff member or external. And so I remember I used to always want to over-prepare for the meetings we were going to because I just didn't want to necessarily be put on the spot. And I hated to be put on the spot because I realized that later on, it was a bit like being with my dad. I actually have a father who's quite strong. And when my father would make a comment, I never wanted to say anything because he always wanted to be right, no matter whether you argued. So I'd over-prepare and over-prepare. And at the end of it, because I was the most senior person, I had to have the answer. So it was an interesting thing. I actually realized that some of the patterns that we have at work are really things that we've learned as children. And we tend to repeat them. So in my studies, I learned about this thing called CCRT. It's actually called Core Conflictual Relationship Theory, which is basic that often we repeat these sort of patterns that we learn as kids. And in my case, when I see someone that's a bit scary to me, who's quite aggressive, I behave like I would with my father, which is I would tend not to react. I tend to not say anything, which is probably not the best thing to do at work. So in summary, I think, you know, the lesson to me was to learn that life is full of these patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's good to be aware of them.
Okay, so being aware was important. Once that you've observed such a pattern occurring, I'm imagining there'd be a time when you had this aha moment when you realized that, you know, the reason why you're unable to deal with people of such sort of aggressive nature or sort of power figure is because of your dad. But then how did you learn to overcome that? What did you have to do to, you know, once you observed that pattern, to break it?
Yeah. I think being aware is obviously a start, but I think sometimes to not default to that behavior, just really just take a breath. Obviously, make sure you prepare. But actually, if you have a point in view and you're able to articulate it, then most people will respect you. And so I think part of it is to actually give things a go and remember that actually sometimes when they're sort of reacting, it may not necessarily be you, it may be them reacting as well. And so just really, you know, thinking about this, reflecting on it, and realizing this is okay. If I have a point of view, that's okay. Yeah.
Is it a case of just getting older and wiser and tougher and, you know, getting used to being okay with conflict? Or is there an aha moment that made you realize, hey, I can deal with this now?
I think you get over these things. I think that's all part of learning to be a leader. But I think I did definitely have a bit of an aha moment, which was probably after all of this, which is why I can actually articulate it now. I don't think I necessarily understood it at the time, but it's definitely been something I've learned about in more recent years.
Yeah, and certainly you wish you knew or you became aware of that earlier on. Awesome. Well, lesson number two, and a very typically Asian one, you said that your family will always be your biggest cheer squad. Tell us about your family.
Yeah, so I'm an eldest child. Very interesting. So back to my dad again. So my dad was always the one that wanted me to be really resilient. So he said, I wanted to toughen you up because I think he felt that, you know, he had to be tough in the world to succeed. And so I've always been pretty independent, you know, went to uni at 17, lived away from home, went overseas and that sort of thing. And so, yeah, being independent is just the way I've been brought up. But, you know, I think I've realized that one of the reasons I do it is actually because I wanted to prove to my family that I was good enough as well, which is something that, you know, sometimes you feel quite insecure about certain things. And I do these things because actually I want to be, I guess, praised by my parents, even though they often tell me, oh, you shouldn't do these things. Like my dad will always says, look, why are you doing this cultural diversity things? No one will respect you. But on the other hand, he comes back to me and says, well, you know, he cheers and tells his friends that this is really good. So I actually think we have to remember that your family is always there. They always are the ones who will assess you, and they'll often be very, very negative to your face. But they're also the ones that will be there for you no matter what happens in your life. And so I think, you know, we shouldn't forget our families. They will always be there to cheer us on.
Yeah, to me, it sounds like your family is just a very, you know, your dad's a very typical Asian dad, you know, high expectation, nothing's ever good enough. You know, they want you to not talk to any boys, but then, you know, as soon as you graduate from university, they want you to be married the day after. that's the kind of life that you see, you know, a lot of Asian people have to contend with. And it sounds like what you're saying is that despite, you know, many protestations on, you know, potentially and criticisms that they have of you, ultimately they want the best of you and that you should continue with your endeavours, you know, because you do make your dad proud.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's very funny when you always hear the friends coming back with the comments. So yeah, you realise actually you're not so bad. So it's been an interesting learning for me.
I wonder how much of it is just a cultural thing where Asian parents just find it difficult to be direct with their compliments or even expressions of love. You know, how often do you hear "I love you" from your parents?
Yeah.
And how much of that is overcoming that inability to openly communicate? And I suppose, you know, as people who travel the world a bit, you know, you kind of be exposed to different cultures where you can choose to, you know, adopt a different way of expressing yourself.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, no, and it's interesting being, you know, fourth generation or Asian Australian, we're not the most talkative about, you know, how we feel. So that going back to some of the other comments earlier about family shaping us, I think it is something that we actually, you know, bring through from different generations from our families.
So. I find that absolutely intriguing, actually, mm-hmm. that comment, because I'd imagine being fourth generation Asian Australian, you would have so much interactions with Australians that, you know, the cultural element would have rubbed off on your family. And yet, four generations on, so much of what was a typical Asian culture was still maintained within your family. How do you explain that?
I don't know. It's a tough one. I think it's just, you know, there are certain, I actually think it's possibly because my family lived through the White Australia policy. And so family was always there to support them. And so those family values were passed on because they thought that was important and they sort of stuck together. So I find it an interesting concept. I mean, I have some very Australian aspects as well about food, which we'll talk about later. And you know, my family don't have three generation families, but, you know, certain values definitely, I think, are from Asia. Yeah.
Well, speaking of generations, your lesson number three says, our future is shaped by our past. Sounds like a bit of a story there again.
Yeah. So, it's an interesting topic. These days, getting asked a lot of questions like, you know, what did you do? When you left uni, and that sort of thing. And honestly, I had no idea what I wanted to do. So I just drifted into roles. I worked with teams. I had some really great opportunities. But if there were things I didn't like, I just decided, no, maybe I'll just go off and do something else. So I've actually realized when I went back to study. That actually a lot of what we do is shaped by our earlier roles in systems. So what I do at work was often shaped by the roles and the things I like doing in my family and then what I did at school. And then if I like it, then I try and find those things. And the other thing is that we often, when we go to work, look for things that help us feel better because of the anxieties in our childhoods. So we often look for certain things. I think I reflected on some of those things earlier. So we want to join companies because of our self-esteem. So I've actually realized that everything we do and things we look for is shaped by what we did in the past, which I think is a very, very powerful thing to understand, particularly when we're trying to understand what things like we'd like to do in future jobs.
Yeah, this sounds like a bit of a psychological conversation, isn't it? So, you know, people have a chip on their shoulders because of, you know, potentially things that they carry from their childhoods. And you mentioned before that you're always trying to do something that you believe will impress your parents. So knowing that insight, what can you do with that information? What do you do knowing that, you know, you're, so much of you is shaped by what happened to you in the past?
Yeah. I think it's useful to reflect on because, like in my case, I actually realized that I like a lot of limelight. In certain cases, and there was a whole concept of stars, actually. You know, I was in a newspaper article when I was seven, and it said Karen is a star. And I did some exercises later, and I realized that I actually wanted appreciation and being like a star. But one of the things I've realized is from some of those exercises is the lens I also use tends to focus on some of these things. When I look at examples of observing things and that sort of thing. So to me, what I think I learned from a lot of this is that you are shaped by your roles, but also the way you look at things also is shaped by that as well, which is a slightly different angle. And being aware of that, some of these, you know, perspectives can actually help you be a lot more wise when you're looking at situations and trying to understand what's going on.
Indeed. Now, you're the second Asian Australian woman that I've interviewed, and I've just, it's a bit of a theme that you're very introspective in terms of, you know, understanding your psychology. So potentially we're onto something here. lesson number four takes a little bit of a different bend, and it sounds like great career advice. And you said in lesson number four, if you're not networking, you're not working. What do you mean by that?
Like a lot of kids who grow up and study hard, you know, had the pressure of the parents. I did also experience some setbacks. You know, when I was a little bit more junior at PwC, I did really well. So I got early promotions, but then eventually I hit a ceiling. I was told that my soft skills weren't so good. Then I was also having another incident when I was going for partnership in Singapore. And I had so much work. I was working. And I was being put up for partnership. And I didn't get through. And so the feedback I got was actually the people didn't know you. They didn't know you as a person. They knew your work, but didn't know you as a person. And so one of the things I've realized, and I still have to remember this myself, is that often, you know, we do perform in ways that is shaped by what we thought was working in the past, which we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, as we get older, we actually need to build and continue to build our networks because that's so important at work. And so I've learned it's not the technical things that you know, it's actually who you know as well. And so that's so important, whether it's your career sponsors, whether it's your mentors and that sort of thing.
Well, there are two aspects of that I'd like to dig into a little bit. So number one is the idea that when you're working, you should be working. You know, networking sounds like you're making friends, you're having fun. Mm. You know, when you're having fun, you can't possibly be working, especially that's kind of, I feel like that's a bit of a mentality a lot of Asian Australians do have. What do you say to that sort of thinking?
I guess when I'm saying networking, we're saying broad networks. And I think there's people need to understand there's different types of networks, whether it's sponsors or mentors or others. So I guess what I'm saying here is that you need a lot of different people to help you during your career because actually we're talking about leadership. Leadership is all about leading others and having followers. But to learn how to be a leader, you probably need others to help you.
Mm.
So it's actually recognizing that you just can't be doing the job. If you want to be actually able to succeed and go into leadership, you need the help of others.
Yeah. Absolutely. And the second part of that, and you said a key word there that you lacked the soft skills.
Mm.
And then the second part, you said that people didn't know who you were as a person.
Mm.
And I know this is very typical of a lot of, especially people of Asian backgrounds, that we tend to be very reserved. We don't let a lot of our personality out. And a lot of that is just because that's the way we're taught, you know. We have this assumption that it's not professional for people to, you know, to act out their personalities. Mm-hmm. So what have you learned in your in the process of, you know, making partner about how to let other people know who you are as a person and what is the ultimate point of knowing you as a person?
Mm. So it's interesting that feedback was actually when I was in Singapore. So I think it's also a combination of who you are as well. So that the people in Singapore didn't know me, but you know, people want to, you know, they don't just want to be transactional and do work with you. They actually want to know whether they can trust you. And a lot, so much of work is actually around trust. Can I trust that this person's going to do the right thing if I actually engage them as a client or they become a colleague? And so only when you really let that guard down and you talk about, you know, whatever it's your food or whatever, and they get to know you as a person, then they can really go, okay, yeah, I think I can get this person. So I think it's moving beyond transactions.
Indeed. And if a person is guarded around you to, you know, let you into their lives, you know, there may be something he's holding back or she's holding back. And that's not necessarily a good way to build trust.
Mm.
Yeah. So that makes a very good point. And speaking of that, lesson number five, and I'm sure this is a very common lesson, imposter syndrome is normal. Now, start with what imposter syndrome is.
Yeah, so imposter syndrome is a situation where you feel really uncomfortable, being like a fraud. That's how where some people describe it. And so basically for my situation, I think the biggest challenge I experienced becoming a leader was when I took on a big client role. So it was about 10 years ago. And I was the first female to take on this role. All the people who'd taken on were male and probably 10 years older. One was a quite an autocratic Chinese leader. The other one was Caucasian. So I didn't fit the mold and I looked really young. And so I remember going along to sit in the boardroom. I had to make myself look a lot older because I also look really young. And I actually really felt pretty intimidated. And it was also the situation where I explained earlier, where I also had the CEO who was also quite sometimes aggressive. So it didn't help. But one of the things I realized, so I was doing my research for my book, I realized that being an imposter or feeling like an imposter is actually pretty normal. Everyone goes through these periods of time, particularly when you're trying to learn to become a leader, because in a way you're acting and trying to behave in a certain way and it feels really, really uncomfortable. But it's actually one of those things that if you get over some of these feelings and you think, okay, I've learned, this is okay, I can do this, then you'll actually be a better person. And so, yeah, it's a normal part of learning.
So is the lesson that you just got to accept that when you start, you're going to feel like an imposter? You know, just knowing that is good enough, or, you know, or is it a case of, you know, just take your time? You will grow into the role that you're trying to play.
I think it's probably a combination. I think if I think about it, maybe we probably feel like imposters as adults, but I was thinking earlier on when I was writing my book, when we're kids, we're not scared. We try lots of things out and we make mistakes, but it's okay. But I think sometimes when it's adults, we get scared and get worried. And so one of the questions possibly is to try and think about, well, why do I feel worried? What's actually holding me back? And maybe if you actually reflect on that a little bit more, then you may be able to deal with these things a little better.
Absolutely. Let's take a quick break here. We'd like to thank our affiliate partner, Audible. Audible is an amazing way to consume 10 lessons learned, books, and other podcasts, allowing you to build a library of knowledge in all in one place. You can start your 30-day free trial by going to audibletrial.com/10lessonslearned. With Audible, you can find your favorite lesson while at home or on the go. Once again, that's audibletrial.com/10lessonslearned, all lowercase, for a 30-day free trial. The link will be in the show notes. And we're back here with Karen Loon. Lesson number 6, don't be scared to look in the mirror. Now, why would you be scared looking in the mirror?
You might see something horrible. No. I guess when I was thinking about this, one of the things I never used to like it at all was getting feedback at work or feedback at school or getting those reports, because you always were scared that you were being criticized. And you know, sometimes, particularly you get more senior, if you didn't trust the feedback, you know, it could be politically motivated or something like that. But I learned more recently that feedback can be extremely positive. So in my program at INSEAD, we actually did a couple of things. We got 720-degree feedback. So most people know of 360-degree feedback, where you get feedback from your bosses, your staff, and your peers. In this case, there was 720-degree feedback. So you also got feedback from your family, which was actually really invaluable and actually was probably the more interesting and the most more accurate feedback about who you are. And then the other thing I did is something called role biographies. So it's something I spoke about a bit earlier. This is a tool where you actually learn about yourself and your roles. And I found out so much about myself. And it can also be done in groups, so not just one-on-one, but actually when you all talk about it in a small group, it actually can be more effective because people see things that you don't see. And I guess that's the main thing. Often you don't see your not faults, but different lenses of you or how you behave or how people feel you are, how you are. And so from that feedback, I guess I'm a lot more aware of how people think of me, how they feel about me. And I think it makes me hopefully a better leader and a better person.
Sure. But it's all easy to say, just embrace that feedback. How did you overcome that fear of negative feedback?
I think I probably will always have it. But I think, you know, if you get used to it and then you try to use that feedback yourself, and then you maybe go back and see how, you know, you've gone, I think, you know, it can be this positive sort of learning cycle as well. And so, you know, I think often we avoid it, but actually that may be something that leads to problems later on. So my suggestion is really to embrace it.
Absolutely. And it's all just part of growing up, right? I think as when we're younger, we're fearful of rejection and feedback and as such. But the more you have it, the more you realize you grow stronger and the more you build that resistance and tolerance to it. So absolutely great advice, embracing feedback, good or bad. Lesson number 7, embrace negative capability. I don't know what negative capability means. Can you help me?
No, and that? I hadn't heard about it until, you know, more recently, but it's a really interesting idea. So it's actually coined by the poet John Keats, and he referred to the ability to live with and tolerate paradox. And to contain. So we're seeing paradox. We're talking about being able to manage two different things, like work, when you talk about work-life balance, you know, actually it's like a bit of a seesaw. And so negative capability is really about the ability to not do something and being patient and having poise. So in my case, I tend to be quite impulsive. So, you know, when someone asks me to do something, I'll do it straight away, which I think is really good at certain types of jobs and was really important in Singapore because clients are really demanding. But actually, I've realized that having those gut reactions and just doing things without necessarily reflecting and analyzing situations, both the rational side, so the facts, but also, you know, what's also happening, may not actually lead to the right decisions. And it's really important for me now because I'm a non-executive director. So around the boardroom table, we're dealing with a lot of complex issues for which there's often no right or wrong answer. So really, you know, I'm getting more used to this importance of negative capability and just being comfortable, being uncomfortable and not reacting straight away and just really trying to think and sleep over, you know, tricky ideas. Some people I spoke to are really good at this. So they write journals. They actually, if they've got complex issues, they try to write a journal, reflect on these things and go back on it. And some other people I know use meditation. So it's definitely something I think for all people, particularly as they get more senior, that they should think about.
And certainly in the tricky situations, you know, sometimes acting too quickly or impulsively tends to make things worse. So I agree with that. Lesson number 8, invest in me time.
Probably very typical of someone who graduated in the 90s. All I wanted to do is start work, earning money, you know, travel overseas and all those things. But I realized one of the things is that once you start work, it's like this treadmill and you run and run and run and you can't get off. And it was really probably only about 10 years ago I had an opportunity at work to have a bit of a break. They said, look, you know, you have some downtime, get yourself ready. Met my husband. You know, got to do some fun things. And so now in my older age, I've actually realized you do need downtime because careers are really long. And you know, if you don't have these breaks, you know, you'll have health problems, you'll get too stressed, you won't learn how to become a better person and that sort of thing. And so I'd just say, you know, invest in me time.
And I like the way you use the word invest. Because there is a return to spending time with yourself or spending time on yourself. So thanks for that. Lesson number 9, and I've heard this one before by Steve Jobs. You say, stay hungry, stay foolish.
Yeah. So, you know, I think careers are really long. So when I think about my career, I started it in audit and we didn't even have personal computers. We basically had a pencil, piece of paper and a calculator.
Whoa, you're giving away your age.
Yeah, you know, so you can probably tell my age here. So, you know, now most of the things that you would do in that era now, you can do it on iPad. And so careers are so long. And so I think one of the things is you just really have to continue to learn, you know, not just the technical stuff, not just the soft skill stuff, but just really try things out because what you've learned at school's not necessarily going to cut it these days.
But is it just about careers, though? I mean, clearly, as the world changes and the speed of change has picked up, you know, it's not just about staying relevant in the workplace. It's about staying relevant in life, isn't it?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
All right. Well, before I get to lesson number 10, I'm going to throw you a bit of a curveball here, Karen. So what is something that you have unlearned? And what I mean by that is something that you held to be ironclad truth when you're starting out in your career in, you know, in your 20s, that you later learned in life through, you know, the hard way that it just wasn't the case.
Oh, that's a really tough question. So I always used to question some of the things my parents did. My parents actually worked really hard. So we're talking about these patterns of work. My parents ran their own business. My dad started his business at 21 and retired or stopped that in his 40s. And I used to wonder why. I used to think, well, you know, surely you want to keep working, keep yourself relevant. But, you know, you can probably see that pattern coming through in a lot of what I've said is actually I've realized that, you know, my parents were probably right. If you keep working too hard, you know, something will give. And so, you know, I've actually learned my dad's probably a lot wiser than I gave him credit for when I was 20. That's probably the main thing. Yeah.
So don't, you're not a machine. Don't just keep working. You've got to take your breaks.
Yep, definitely.
Excellent. Well, the last and my favorite lesson, and not because I love food. Oh, actually, yes, it is because I love food. The best way to bond is over food.
Yeah. So these days, one of the things that my husband and I love is we're foodies. And it's interesting because I grew up in Australia, and unlike most Asian Australians, I grew up on a diet of white bread, Vegemite sandwiches and meat pies, which is pretty disgusting. But
look, 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago, I would have said, oh, lucky you. But it's a different time now. I think we would say, oh, mate, you know, sorry to hear that.
Anyway. I went to Singapore, and obviously the food's very different there. And then when you travel, I used to travel a lot in the region. So you realize that especially when you're in environments where you're under pressure and you work hard, the best way to get to know people and get to know their culture is over food. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whether it's, you know, kaseki meals in Japan, or whether it's, who knows what in other countries, they're just amazing things. And so today my husband and I we actually pick our holidays based on food destinations, not the other way around. And the first thing we do when we get to countries is we actually pick the restaurants we want to eat, and then we decide what we want to do. But it's the most amazing way to get to, learn about new things, learn about new cultures, and meet people that you normally wouldn't meet. Because if you, build up relationships, strike conversations with foodies, they're often people you'd never deal with. And so I'd say just bond over food, because it's just so much fun.
Because everyone eats.
Everyone has to eat.
Yeah, well, I think almost everyone loves food. Mm. And certainly, I like the idea of meeting new people or trying out new things. But does it necessarily have to be, new kind of food? Can it be just the same kind of food as what you always liked?
Can be both. I mean, new food, I think, is great to find out about new ideas, but, there's also a whole lot of comfort you get from familiar foods as well. Yeah. So, to me, family and friends is often kind of comfortable food, but trying new things out, particularly if you ever go to Singapore, which has a really great food scene, I think is great too.
And you just made me hungry. Well, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, Karen. And I've learned a bit about your life and how you came to be the person that you are today, and really appreciate the lessons that you've shared. And we'll finish on that note. You've been listening to the podcast, 10 Lessons Learned, where we dispense wisdom for career, business and life. Our guest today has been Karen Loon, sharing the 10 lessons it took her years to learn. This episode is produced by Robert Hossery and sponsored by the Professional Development Forum. Don't forget to leave us a review or comment. You can even email us at podcast@10lessonslearned.com. That's podcast@10lessonslearned.com. Go ahead and hit that subscribe button so that you don't miss an episode of the only podcast that makes the world a little wiser, lesson by lesson. Thanks for listening, and stay safe, everyone.